Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. And if you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, now is a great time, especially if you've been listening to the show over the past year and you're thinking, you know what? I want to help support the growth of the show. You can do it for as little as $5 a month on Patreon or Locals. That's patreon.com. patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. In a moment, we're going to talk about the big story of the day, which is that horrible attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband at their home in California. I've got some thoughts on that, and it might sound like I'm chewing some of you out today, and yeah, I'm going to chew some of you out today, a very small fraction of you. But I saw some comments about this that are just honestly angering me, making me a little sick. So we'll talk about that. We're also going to talk about Elon Musk officially taking over Twitter and already clearing house, apparently. And the meltdown over this continues. I mean, there has been a slow churning meltdown ever since Elon Musk announced that he was trying to buy the company. And now that he's officially in charge of the company, it's just fascinating to see some of what people think might happen to Twitter. So we'll discuss that. Also, are attitudes among Seattle voters changing? I know we always kind of think that Seattle has hit rock bottom, and so maybe Seattle voters are changing their political preferences. But there was this really interesting survey out of registered voters, likely voters in the city of Seattle, that talks about their attitudes on the homeless crisis, the crime crisis. And I have to say, there is overwhelming support, it seems, to take Seattle in a new direction. So we'll discuss that. But first, of course, I want to talk about the attack on Paul Pelosi. So what we know, and again, this is not a breaking news show. It's not taped live. And so this is obviously a developing story. And so details might change by the hour, so I'm not going to get too much into the nitty-gritty, but apparently Paul Pelosi is at their home in San Francisco. Nancy Pelosi was not there when an intruder came in. According to some news outlets, saying, hey, where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? Ends up attacking Paul Pelosi, who's 82 years old, with a hammer. Luckily, he's going to be okay. But here's a little bit of what we heard from police during a press conference earlier today.
At approximately 2:27 this morning, San Francisco police officers were dispatched to the residence of Speaker Nancy Pelosi regarding an A-priority well-being check. When the officers arrived on scene, they encountered an adult male and Mr. Pelosi's husband, Paul. Our officers observed Mr. Pelosi and the suspect both holding a hammer. The suspect pulled the hammer away from Mr. Pelosi and violently assaulted him with it. Our officers immediately tackled the suspect, disarmed him, took him into custody, requested emergency backup, and rendered medical aid. The suspect has been identified as 42-year-old David DePepe. Mr. Pelosi and Mr. DePepe were transported to a local hospital for treatment. This is an active investigation currently being led by the San Francisco Police Department Special Investigations Division. We are working closely with our partners from the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the U.S. Capitol Police, and our district attorney here in San Francisco County, D.A. Brooke Jenkins, and her team. The motive for this attack is still being determined. Mr. DePepe will be booked at the San Francisco County Jail on the following charges: attempted homicide, assault with a deadly weapon, elder abuse, burglary, and several other additional felonies.
So let's state the obvious. Acts of political violence are unacceptable, and unfortunately, they're becoming more frequent. And you know, no matter who perpetrates them and for what reason or what cause, you know, that includes the riots that happened across the country. Yes, that includes the individuals who threatened Supreme Court justices. And yes, that includes this person who beat Paul Pelosi with a hammer. And I realize that motivations and all of that are still being sorted out. But, you know, again, if you've got him entering Nancy Pelosi's home, you know, asking, where's Nancy? I think it's pretty clear what the motivation is here. And that's another, just as an aside, how do you just get into the home of the third most powerful politician in the country? That's baffling to me. And also, I will say, I think anyone who commits acts like this have to be mentally disturbed. I mean, if you feel like the solution to your political disagreements is to physically harm someone, you're mentally disturbed. I mean, I think about, you know, even including the people who were throwing poop, human feces at Councilwoman Shama Sawant in Seattle's house. Like, what is mentally wrong with you? So it's disappointing to see the direction of our country. Absolutely horrifying. But I'll tell you what's almost as horrifying are the people who are rushing to excuse this behavior. And let me tell you what I mean by that. So I posted on my Facebook one of the stories from Fox News about this. And I saw right away that some of the responses to it were laughing emojis. Like, I'm posting a story about, if nothing else, an 82-year-old man who was beat severely with a hammer. And some people chose to respond to it with a laughing emoji. I mean, come on. Does politics and political differences consume that much of your life, that much of your morality, that that's your response to a man being beat with a hammer? For the love of God. And I realize it's not everybody, but even a handful. And I'm like, why are you on my page? Is that what we preach, political violence on this show? Of course not. I'm just going to read some of these. Maybe if he'd had a firearm, he'd have been better prepared to defend himself. Come on. Are we going to blame Paul Pelosi for being beat with a hammer while in his own home? He should have had a gun. This is ridiculous. Let's see. There was one in here about Paul Pelosi's drinking. This family likes to get hammered. Come on. If you are so hateful that you are making light of a guy who got beat with a hammer because you don't like his wife. Come on, guys. We have to do better than that. This isn't healthy. It's not good for the country. It's not good for us. It's not good for you as an individual. And then, you know, more broadly than that, some of the reactions of like folks in the conservative media or folks who are prominent conservative figures on Twitter who are saying, oh, this seems suspicious. We need to wait for more details in this. Okay, I'm fine with waiting for details. I'm fine with not jumping to conclusions about anything. But I would challenge them and say, would you feel the same way if this had happened to the spouse of a Republican? Did you say that when it came to the Brett Kavanaugh incident? If you had the spouse of a Republican politician who was beaten in their own home, you're telling me you would say, oh, wait, let's not jump to conclusions. Let's see what's going on here. Of course you wouldn't. And again, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing to wait for information without jumping to conclusions, but are you going to do it equally? Or are you going to have your reaction depend on the politics of the person who was injured, the person who was targeted, the person who was assaulted? I think most of those people who are saying that know the answer. And, you know, Glenn Youngkin, which this disappoints me from Glenn Youngkin, of course, the governor of Virginia. Glenn Youngkin is at this campaign event, and he's, you know, I mean, it is campaign season. I'm not saying everyone has to cease campaign events because of what happened to Paul Pelosi, right? But Glenn Youngkin, so he is out campaigning for a GOP congressional candidate, and he should have just not even mentioned Nancy Pelosi because there's so many other people he could have talked about. And this is what he said.
Listen, Speaker Pelosi's husband, they had a break-in last night in their house and he was assaulted. There's no room for violence anywhere, but we're going to send her back to be with him in California. That's what we're going to go do.
Glenn, I mean, he couldn't have just left it at, hey, this is terrible. I don't condone political violence. Our thoughts and our prayers are with Paul Pelosi, hoping for a full recovery. No, you had to go on to, and you know what? Let's send Nancy Pelosi back home to take care of him. Come on. Who are these people? And it's like behavior like this. I mean, no one, no matter how extreme their views are, if they are in public office in this country, should have to worry about themselves and their families being the target of political violence. I think it's stuff like this and this vitriol and this hatred that is leading to directly correlating with low candidate quality, because you have people who are like sane, who are like, I don't want anything to do with that. Why would I want something to do with that? Why would I want to drag my family into this environment? So, you know, I don't want to ever feel like I'm lecturing you guys. And I know that the vast majority of people who are listening to this have nothing but positive thoughts for Paul and Nancy Pelosi today. But I wish for the segment of the population that cannot leave politics out of anything, I would just encourage you to just really be introspective today about how would I have reacted to this story if it were the husband of a politician that I like? And am I willing, am I ready to change my behavior moving forward, have a consistent moral compass, and to stop dragging politics into every single situation? I promise you'll be happier. And also, it's easier to be morally consistent moving forward. You treat everybody, actions before affiliation. We always talk about that, actions before affiliation. When you judge everything based on actions without any care or consideration for someone's political affiliation of the person involved, then you can be consistent moving forward. You never have to think back about, okay, well, how did I react when this happened to Paul Pelosi? And do I have to react the same now? Or it's just ridiculous. So anyway, again, horrible at the base level, 82-year-old man being beat with a hammer in his home is absolutely horrifying. I'm glad he's alive. And I'm thinking about the Speaker of the House and her family, praying that this country can get back to a place where this is not normal. Okay, Elon Musk has now officially taken over Twitter. Man, we went back and forth for a while. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Well, it's happening. He posted some videos of him walking into Twitter headquarters, and apparently there's already some house cleaning going on. Now, some of this might have been of their own accord or Elon Musk clearing house, but the CEO of Twitter and the finance chief have left the company. And Elon Musk is apparently, he tweeted, "The bird is free," about where Twitter is going to go from here. So, of course, there is just a complete meltdown over this from the left on Twitter. And I think up to this point, Twitter has been more of a platform for the left, whereas Facebook, I find, is more of a platform for the right. And I know there's some exceptions to that, but I think the left have used Twitter better, and certainly politically speaking. And so I think they're worried they're going to lose control over it. You know, Twitter, when it comes to censorship has been more heavy-handed when it comes to the right than when it comes to the left. And also, you know, censorship became about squashing not just dissenting opinions, but opinions that Twitter believed were too far outside the mainstream. For instance, people who don't believe in transgenderism, people who believe you're born what you're born and you can't just change your gender identity and expect everyone to go along with that. And so Twitter would often suspend accounts for sentiments like that. And so I think you're going to see that start to change under Elon Musk. But I just laughed at some of the meltdowns. So the New York Times did this article about Elon Musk buying Twitter, and the headline was, "What should Twitter users do?" After Elon Musk took over Twitter, some users wondered if they should take additional measures to protect their accounts or even delete them. What should Twitter users do? And I tweeted in response to that, grow up. If you want to use Twitter, use it. If you don't want to use Twitter, don't use it. I genuinely don't see what's so hard about that. Elon Musk, though, he's trying to kind of calm some of these concerns that Twitter is just going to become a free-for-all. You know, there's conversations about him doing away with permanent bans. For instance, is the president, a former president of the United States, Donald Trump, going to get his Twitter account back? It seems like that's likely under Elon Musk. But he was trying to, first of all, calm advertisers' concerns. Because he is a businessman, right? So he wants to make sure that advertisers aren't going to flee Twitter under some sort of pressure from the far left to say, oh, Elon Musk is going to allow racism and hatred and all these things. So he posted on Twitter. He said, "Dear Twitter advertisers," and he wrote this lengthy thing. I won't read it all, but he said, "I wanted to reach out personally to share my motivation in acquiring Twitter. There has been much speculation about why I bought Twitter and what I think about advertising. Most of it has been wrong. The reason I acquired Twitter is because it is important to the future of civilization to have a common digital town square where a wide range of beliefs can be debated in a healthy manner without resorting to violence. There is currently great danger that social media will splinter into far-right and far-left echo chambers that generate more hate and divide our society. In the relentless pursuit of clicks, much of traditional media has fueled and catered to those polarized extremes, as they believe that is what brings in the money. But in doing so, the opportunity for dialogue is lost. That is why I bought Twitter. I didn't do it because it would be easy. I didn't do it to make more money. I did it to try to help humanity, whom I love. And I do so with humility, recognizing that failure in pursuing this goal, despite our best efforts, is a very real possibility." He went on to say, "That said, Twitter obviously cannot become a free-for-all hellscape where anything can be said with no consequences." So how is he going to strike the right balance, I think, is the question. So one of the things he said he's going to do is form a content moderation council. He said, "Twitter will be forming a content moderation council with widely diverse viewpoints. No major content decisions or account reinstatements will happen before that council convenes." And I do trust Elon Musk to bring in truly a variety of voices, including a variety of voices, ideologically diverse voices. I think ideological differences are often left out when it comes to conversations about diversity. So I like that idea. And Elon Musk, I would love to be on your content moderation council if you're interested in having a small-time podcaster on. But you know, for all these people, there's always folks who, when there was news of Elon Musk maybe buying Twitter a few months ago, they were like, "I'll leave Twitter." And of course they haven't left Twitter. Of course they're not going to leave Twitter. But yeah, it's just ridiculous. I mean, do I want a place where people can post death threats and all measure of horrible things? You know, I hope he doesn't let it get too off the rails. But it is clear to most reasonable people that Twitter's moderation policies went too far, if the goal is truly to allow for free speech. And so I think he can rein that in. I think he can make it a better business model. I also had to laugh quickly. So he posts this, there's this picture of him meeting with folks at Twitter headquarters. And they're in like, I think what is like a coffee bar at headquarters coffee bar. You see all these Twitter employees surrounding him, like, just like they, "Oh, I want to be close to Elon. I want to hear everything he has to say." And I just laugh because remember how much shit these Twitter employees were talking about Elon Musk and leaking all these emails that they were sending, angry about the possible acquisition. And it's like, yesterday they were shit talkers and today they're kissers because they want to please Elon Musk. And it's like, well, I don't know if that's going to save your job, buddy. One more thing about all this. Amazing what the mainstream media will jump on and believe. So there were these two guys outside Twitter headquarters with boxes. Okay, there's these pictures of them surfacing. Because of course, there's all these media cameras outside Twitter headquarters, just waiting. Like, is Elon going to walk out? Are people going to be fired en masse? So there's these two guys, and I will admit, they do look like techies, right? And they've got cardboard boxes, presumably with all their stuff in it, okay? And these reporters are just like, "Who are you? Da, da, da." Well, it turns out that those people were pranksters. So this is hilarious. So this woman named Deirdre Bosa, who works for CNBC Tech, she tweets out a picture of them saying, "It's happening. Entire team of data engineers, let go. These are two of them. Hashtag Twitter takeover." And it's got the picture of these two guys. She goes on to tweet, "They are visibly shaken. Daniel tells us he owns a Tesla and doesn't know how he's going to make his payments." Oh my God, okay. So these guys are standing out there. I mean, at some point it becomes pretty obvious they're trolling these journalists. One of them holds up, in his box, one of the things he has in his box is Michelle Obama's book, Becoming. Oh my God. So just feeding in this narrative that these like left, you know, left-leaning Twitter people got canned by Elon Musk on day one. So anyway, it ends up being confirmed that so there's a product manager at Twitter that says that these people don't work there. It says, so Paulie, who's a product manager at Twitter, said, quite ironic that a major news outlet failed to do basic diligence and fell for a crisis actor prank, resulting in the spread of misinformation on the first day of new ownership. All you had to do was ask to see a badge or look for bird-themed stuff in the boxes. Also, we don't use Zoom because there was a, these guys said they were fired over Zoom, right? But anyway, I go back to this reporter from CNBC who initially tweeted this out. And remember what she tweeted out. She said, I mean, it was unequivocal. She said, it's happening. An entire team of data engineers let go. These are two of them. Hashtag Twitter takeover. So then she starts to try to backtrack really quickly. She says, FYI, some questions are being raised about whether these are really Twitter employees still trying to verify. Didn't you already verify? Because you sounded pretty sure that they were. And she continues, confusion reigns outside Twitter headquarters. Are people being let go? Are they trolling the media? And then she goes, unfortunately, corporate communications isn't returning calls. So now she blames her lack of due diligence on Twitter corporate communications. And then she tweets out, original tweet still up and everything. Earlier today, we reported on CNBC that a team of data engineers was let go at Twitter based on the account of two people who told us they were part of that team. We have not been able to confirm that they were actual employees or that the company has laid anyone off today. Well, it would have been good, probably, Deidre, to do that due diligence before you breathlessly reported that these two men had been fired by Elon Musk on day one. It's not uncommon for the biggest city in a state to decide elections, and that's certainly the case in Washington, where Seattle voters essentially determine who's in, at least in state, obviously statewide office races, who's going to win elections. Much to the frustration of a lot of people outside Seattle, which is why I thought it was interesting. There was this survey that came out from the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, and they do this index, they call it twice a year, where they gauge the most important issues for Seattleites, you know, the biggest challenges that they're concerned about, and also kind of gauge their level of satisfaction with the direction of the city. So the latest index that was released in October showed that even Seattleites are incredibly concerned about issues like homelessness and crime. And the level of concern is pretty astonishing. And it really makes me wonder going into this election, whether you're gonna have Seattle voters, typically the most progressive in the state of Washington, considering voting outside the party that they'd normally vote for. Just to give you an example, so 69% of those who responded said that they believe Seattle's on the wrong track. 78% said that they do not believe that the quality of life is better today than it was 4 years ago. 78%. That's pretty astonishing. When asked, what are the issues facing Seattle that you are most frustrated or concerned about? 57% said homelessness. 45% said crime, drugs, public safety. And then look at all these things that trailed distant third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. Racial issues, cleanliness of city, cost of living. So, you know, those are the issues I think that progressives talk the most about, right? About the climate, about racial issues and policing and police brutality and affordable housing. But look at where they rank on the true concerns among Seattleites. Very low. The top two, overwhelmingly, homelessness and crime, drugs, and public safety. I mean, I'm not surprised by that, but I wonder if Seattle's progressive politicians are surprised by that. So they were also asked, how much impact do you think each of the following would have on improving the quality of life in Seattle? So essentially, what needs to be done to make Seattle better? 65% said that closing homeless encampments in parks, on sidewalks, and in public right-of-ways would have a very significant impact on improving the city of Seattle. 58% said addressing violent crime and gun violence would have a significant impact on improving the quality of life in Seattle. 53% said helping local businesses deal with public safety concerns would have a very significant impact. Other things that ranked high: addressing property crime like theft and car break-ins, maintaining bridges and infrastructure. That was like the only non-crime one to score high. Another one: addressing organized retail theft. So again, these seem like very moderate, reasonable demands of a citizenry that sees its city not doing very well. Now, there were a couple in here that I was like, wow, this really stands out to me. Because what do we talk about on the show a lot? How the loudest voices in the room, you have these little groups of people, but they scream so loud that they seem like their voices carry further, that they have more of a impact than they really do, that they represent more of the populace than they really do. And I think this statistic really drove that home for me. So the question was, do you support or oppose this? Continue to close homeless encampments once people have been offered shelter and services, even if it means those who refuse help will be displaced. So this is basically saying, do you support homeless sweeps of homeless encampments, if people have been offered shelter and services, and it means that this person is going to be displaced, do you still support that? 82% said they supported it. 82%. And we're led to believe that if you support this, you're a terrible person, you know, by the far left activists. Well, are 82% of Seattleites terrible people? 18% said they support it. 64% said they strongly support it. So for a total of 82%, that's significant by any standard. And I think it really should be a wake-up call for progressive politicians, for liberal Democrats, even moderate Democrats, about what the priorities of their electorate really is and what people really care about, and the fact that things are getting so far out of hand. So I spoke with the president of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, Rachel Smith, as well as Andrew Thibault, who's an expert pollster at EMC Research, which conducted this index. And we talked about some of their big takeaways. Rachel and Andrew, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having us. Great to see you.
So I love seeing these when they come out, because I think, you know, as a talking head, we think we know what the public wants, what they're concerned about, but it's always good to see it by the numbers. So Andrew, just I think most important thing with anything like this is how did you get this information? Who'd you ask?
Yeah, so this is what we call a mixed mode survey. And what that means is, in addition to cell phones and those few landlines that still exist, we do email to web and text to web to get a fully representative sample. Our target universe was all registered voters. So not likely voters, but all registered voters, because we wanted to cast the widest net. We did this in the third week of September. We did 700 total interviews across the city, which has an overall margin of error plus or minus 3.9 points. So a pretty robust sample, which allows us to look at subgroup data.
And do you kind of, in an effort to get representative data, do you end up tossing out some replies?
Well, if they complete, yes, we do have targets across a whole series of demographics. So if we're over quota on any individual demographic, we will not use that interview, because we want it to be representative of the voter population as a whole across the city.
And how do you decide who's interview to throw out, if that's the case?
Oh, well, so it would just, all of it is random whose number comes up. And then if we get to the end of the interview and say we have a specific quota on voters over the age of 65, and it turns out at the end of the survey, this newest respondent is over 65, and we don't need that interview, we toss it out.
Gotcha. So Rachel, what do you guys hope to get every time this survey is done? What do you hope to glean from it?
Yeah. So, you know, some people ask, why does the business community do quality of life research? And we do quality of life research because attracting and retaining employees, either to move here or to stay here, is really critical. You know, our employers and their employees live and work and recreate and have families and indeed vote here. It also really impacts the decisions of the businesses and business owners to stay or to locate here. Additionally, I really think that through the index, we fill a major gap in our civic dialogue by surfacing voter opinions and adding them into the conversation.
Is there anything that struck you particularly this time compared to last index?
Yeah, I had a couple of takeaways. One of those is that, and you know, this comes from, I think, just like many years of looking at data and sitting in focus groups and things like that. And that is that I really think the voters of Seattle are progressive, and they want to see a plan, and they want their priorities to be reflected in the priorities of our leaders, and they want to see progress being made. Two, I think that interestingly, when we look at the three issues that were the top issues last August, they were the same top issues this March and the same top issues this September. But there was a little bit of a difference there. Of note, I think homelessness, which is still the top priority, there is a downward trend there, dropping 8 points, 12%, which I would argue is because people are seeing that progress is being made, that there is a you know, sort of regional all hands on deck approach to addressing homelessness, which is why you're seeing that downward trend. However, affordability and public safety both took a sharp rise in March and have really stayed steady. And public safety is now the cited as the top reason for people who are considering moving out of Seattle. And then the last takeaway that I have is really that there is some optimism there. There's a hopefulness that we really share at the chamber. And when you look at, you know, the needle maybe didn't move a lot, but it consistently moved in the right direction. The overall index number is up, right track is up and wrong track is down. A majority of Seattle voters are optimistic about the future of the region. And over 70% of people are proud to call themselves a Seattleite. So to me, that is good news. It means there's momentum and an opportunity for our leaders to be responsive to what the voters want to see through the Seattle City budget, through the comprehensive plan to increase housing, et cetera. So we see a path for action here.
Yeah, and I think more broadly, one of the interests for me, and especially before an election that's really critical, where Seattle and King County are going to decide a lot of things. As you said, Seattle voters are progressive. And there's this idea that progressive voters don't care about being safe. You know, they don't care about, they don't mind the homeless crisis. And that's just not true. And I think that this number shows this. Andrew, I was curious about a question that was included. And maybe you're told specifically what questions to ask. I'm assuming, Rachel, you guys have input in that. But the question of, are you proud to be a Seattleite, is interesting, comparatively to other things. What does that, adding a question like that, kind of add to the equation?
Yeah, well, you know, Seattle voters are really nuanced in their attitudes. And when you look back at the story this is telling, there's a lot of, you know, difficult news to hear. But we really wanted to be clear to surface attitudes. Voters haven't given up on Seattle. They see a lot of really significant challenges right now. But even this, despite this broader pessimism, there is this ray of hope, and there is this, you know, optimism. You know, it's maybe, you know, cautious optimism, but it's still there. And we didn't want to make it seem like, with these questions, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. There is a lot of good news in this, and the optimism and the pride are certainly part of that. But in a city that likes to, because we're most voters are on the same side of the ideological spectrum, likes to argue about very narrow questions quite stridently, to see the level of consensus throughout this survey that we saw, consensus for Seattle, was really, it made me feel good. It was nice to see, because it suggests that there really is this opportunity right now, as we're all seeing the same challenges and are relatively aligned on approaches to solving them. There's this opportunity to make a visible difference. And it hasn't been that way for a while. You know, there had been, you know, the frame of Seattle elections was about who's the most progressive, and Seattle voters are getting back to their roots, which is really practical progressivism, right? Lead with compassion and progressive values, but we need to move the ball forward.
Yeah, and I'll just add one quick thing to that, which is I think a lot of times a lot of people are speaking for us. A lot of people are characterizing what we think of ourselves here in Seattle, or they're characterizing what they think we should think of ourselves. And this is really an opportunity for us to speak for ourselves. So are you proud to call yourself a Seattleite? And again, overwhelming majority, over 70% said yes.
Well, and I think there's a good point in there, which is you can be critical of your city, but still love it. And I would argue that loving your city, being critical and wanting it to do better is part of loving it. And I think that's what people forget in the kind of crush to you know, criticize over crime and the state of things. Andrew, anything statistically speaking that you thought was significant or odd to you?
Not odd, I would say. This really isn't about a single question, and Rachel mentioned it, but consistently across almost all of the questions, there's this small movement in a positive direction. And the challenge is going to be to sustain that trend and help it gather momentum. But it's the first time in a while, you know, we've seen here and there things looking like they might be a little bit better, but consistently across the survey questions, we saw that this time.
And I would add, when we're looking specifically at housing affordability, Brandy, as you know, DOT's always asked a lot of questions around that. And I think there is this conventional wisdom that, you know, we have strong majorities who are very concerned about, you know, adding duplexes and triplexes in their neighborhood, or that renters and homeowners are wildly different in their opinions about adding housing to their neighborhoods. And it turns out that's not true. And so to the point that you made earlier about we may think we know, but I think what you're seeing here is that voters in the city of Seattle are saying, we are comfortable with having, you know, more neighbors, with more opportunities for people to age in place, or for younger people to be able to buy homes, and to have more homes in more neighborhoods. And so that was, I guess, not surprising to me, because maybe I did expect that, but I think it could be surprising to others.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of it, I think, is because of the media. And, you know, I think I'm not guiltless in that, but you get the extremes, right? You get the pro and the con, and there's so many people who are in the middle who just need a little more information on it. Andrew, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the top three issues, homelessness, public safety, and affordability, I mean, this puts a little pressure on the conventional wisdom in all three of those areas, right? Voters are much more united on how to approach homelessness. Voters who want police reform, which is most Seattle voters, also want to hire officers. It's where Rachel is really fond of saying it's not either or, it's both and. And then on housing, you know, the conventional wisdom is single family homeowners are anti-density, and they're holding up all of this. And, you know, we asked a question about supporting regulations to allow more density in single family home zones, even if it means more duplexes and triplexes in most Seattle neighborhoods. 59% of homeowners are on board with that. Like, yeah. I don't think if you said that to somebody without this backup data, they would give it much credibility.
And they're united. Some might say they're undivided, just to put that out there.
You always get points when you sneak that in. I know you didn't know that, but now you get 15 Brandy points.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I was interested on the numbers on, because again, when you talk about kind of loudest voices in the room, I was really fascinated to see the responses on how people want a homeless camp, quote unquote, sweeps to be done, where they say, yeah, we're compassionate, we want people to be offered services. But by and large, people said, yeah, if they have to be displaced, if they're not accepting services, we're fine with that.
That is something new that we did this time. We asked a series of supportive post questions around homelessness, public safety, and affordability. And we added these. We didn't make it easy. We didn't just say continue to close homeless encampments once people have been offered shelter and services. We added that phrase at the end that said, even if it means those who refuse help will be displaced. And in uber progressive Seattle, to have 82% support that and 64% strongly support tells you how badly people want to see action.
And that was also true in one of the public safety questions that we asked around, again, that even if it means by funding more officers, we will have less resources to fund other services. And I think that was an intentionally high bar, because we wanted to see where are people on that. And again, I think in both cases, you saw strong majorities.
Yeah, and I think the nuance is good. And a lot of people's opinions on these matters are nuanced. And so, yeah, it did create a high bar, but it gives us a better reflection of how people think and how they're feeling. And so I liked how the questions were worded. Rachel, I don't know if you knew this, but there's a lot of city council seats that will be up next year. So if you were one of the seven city council members who are going to have to run to keep their seats, how would you suggest they use this data to inform their campaigns?
It's a great question. And, you know, I think importantly, this is not a political poll. As you know, it's not a who's up, who's down. It is really just about the issues. But I think that any candidate who aligns their positions with the voters, any candidate who can show results or talk about the results that they're going to be able to show if they are elected, they're going to do well in Seattle. You know, again, Seattle voters are progressive, as I said before, but they want to see a plan. They want to see their priorities reflected in the priorities of their leaders, and they want to see progress. And so I think that there is there's going to be an interest in seeing candidates and or incumbents who have a bias towards action, who have a plan on the issues that are most important to the voters, and who are sympathetic to the fact that we need to lead with compassion and we need to show progress.
Yeah. And I mean, this is my opinion, not yours. But I think it's going to be challenging for some council members like Lisa Herbold and Dawn Strauss, who, you know, ran in 2019 saying we want more officers, turned around, pledged to defund, turned around and said they're going to help hire more officers. And so I think when you see that level of flip flopping, it's like, okay, are you just reading the survey results, the index results, and tailoring your position to that? So I think there's going to be council members who have a lot of work to do to convince folks that they mean what they say. But again, it's my opinion. I won't put that on you. Andrew, if you were offering advice to candidates or either incumbents or new political candidates when it comes to how they should interpret this data, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I would say that there isn't any secret about what voters want and what approaches they support. And, you know, you would do yourself a service to pay attention to that. One of the ways I like to think about this data is it's a city council meeting where everybody shows up, right? Or it's Twitter where everybody's commenting. Well, that might be a little too overwhelming.
We don't want that.
It really gives those who don't maybe have the time or inclination to show up to city council meetings or, you know, have reasons that they can't, it surfaces their voices in a way that a city council meeting can't, and they're being very, very clear in what they're saying. And so just like you listen to people who come to city council meetings, you should listen to this data.
And again, that's part of why we put it out, right? Is so that leaders know and therefore have the opportunity to align with the voters and to be responsive to what they hear.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing we've been seeing in all our polling is voters are just desperate for visible progress on these issues, desperate.
As we all should be desperate at this point, right, for visible progress on these issues. Rachel and Andrew, good stuff. I appreciate you getting this data and bringing it to us. I think some of it's not surprising, but it is really good to know. And hopefully the next time, it's yearly, right? Or is it?
We'll be doing it twice a year. Yeah. Okay. So we'll be doing a fall and a spring. So the next one will probably be in the March timeframe.
Okay. I have a lot of hope that people will be, you know, happier with the state of things in March. So we'll check back with you then.
Perfect. Definitely agree
Thank
with
you
that.
Thank you so much for having Thank us. You.
In case you are not an undivided subscriber, on the show on Wednesday, we do a subscriber-only episode every Wednesday, I aired our full sit-down with U.S. Senate candidate Tiffany Smiley, the Republican who's challenging Senator Patty Murray. Also with her here campaigning for Tiffany Smiley in Washington State was Iowa Senator Joni Ernst. So we sat down, we had a really good conversation about the issues that matter to undecided voters. And by the way, in the interest of making sure as many voters see election-related interviews as possible, we've now lifted the paywall on Wednesday's episode, so you can watch that for free on Patreon or Locals. We lifted that today, so gave subscribers a little early glimpse at it. But of course, we want to make sure that any voter who wants to see the interview can see the interview. So you can go check that out. But, you know, one of the things I talked with Tiffany Smiley about is the fact that just a few years ago, her and Patty Murray were very complimentary of one another. You know, Patty Murray had been working with Tiffany Smiley on veterans issues, Patty Murray spoke, you know, in a very positive way about Tiffany Smiley's work on veteran issues from the floor of the Senate. Tiffany Smiley had thanked Patty Murray for her help with Washington families. And so, you know, here you have these two women that didn't know at the time, of course, that they were going to be in this heated battle for the U.S. Senate seat, one of Washington's U.S. Senate seats now in 2022, but who just 3-4 years ago really thought highly of one another. And so that's an issue that I brought up with Tiffany Smiley in our interview.
You posted on Twitter recently, I think it was from 2018, Patty Murray on the Senate floor talking about you and your family.
To this day, Tiffany is an amazing advocate for the caregiver program and what it has meant to her and to her family.
You also in the past have said nice things about Patty Murray. In our very first interview, I brought up a picture a few years ago you posted side by side thanking her for her work for Washington families. Yeah. Do you stand by that sentiment? Do you still share that sentiment about Patty Murray?
Yeah, that's who I am. I will work with anyone. But look, I saw a lack of leadership over this last several years when our kids were shuttered out of school for over a year and a half. I'm a mom of 3 school-age boys. Senator Murray was nowhere to be found. She was a champion of shutting down schools. She even went to the Senate floor and stopped a bill from allowing parents to decide if we should mask our children or not. I saw the damage that it did. So have parents all over Washington State. And then she went on the Senate floor June of 2020, called for funds to be diverted from our police force, and she disappeared and went into hiding while our city was ravished. Crime is all over Washington State, hurting our communities. We're less safe. Why didn't she stand up for us? I'm not talking bad about Senator Murray. I'm talking about her policy. I'm talking about the issues that are facing Washington families. That's what this election is about.
Again, you can watch that full interview at patreon.com/undivided or on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. I'll also be posting it, just the interview itself, as a bonus podcast episode for those of you who prefer to listen to the show rather than watch it. All right, we're going to end the Friday show there. I know we usually end the show with a bunch of reoccurring segments. My sister, though, has got the week off. She's in Vegas for a concert, so no Florida report this week. And I think with elections coming up, we're going to have so much election content that we might just shake things up a little bit until the election is over. But again, go check out that Tiffany Smiley interview alongside Senator Joni Ernst. We have invited, by the way, Senator Patty Murray to come on the show as well, of course. Would love to sit down with her and talk about the issues. So far, have not heard back from her campaign, but we're going to be focusing on some of the other issues at play, including what I think is the single most important race in the state of Washington, the race for King County prosecutor. All of that coming up next week on Undivided. I will see all of you on Monday. Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.